Thank you very much, Tristan, for an incredibly informative and thought-provoking talk. Okay, so we have a first question then from Jordan. Jordan, would you like to go ahead?
Yeah, sure. I also just want to say, like, what Tristan meant was like if you go to the bottom and you click reactions, you can click raise hand. Like, there's a bunch of other ones too. But yeah, aside from that, I mainly just wanted to say that I agree, man. Like, I'm big on like Linux and like, you know, I think people need to start using like open source decentralized social media more, like Mastodon. There's like a few others, but like, you know, it's obviously it's hard to do that. You know, we'll get people to want to. If they don't really understand the benefits of it, you know, obviously the general consensus is like, oh, get Instagram, get Twitter, da 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 da. And I mean, those are great, obviously, to reach people, you know, to reach the average person. But I think there needs to be like a huge, you know, especially for socialists for sure, like anybody who is at risk of being like tracked or anything on regular social media, like banned and stuff, like should definitely be making that exodus to, you know, decentralized and open source means of communication and like social media sharing and stuff. But yeah, do I think that'll ever happen overall? I think it'll have to. I think it'll have to at some point, just because things are only gonna get worse. Like, I mean, we're already at a point where people are getting banned for like just saying facts, like literally just saying facts, like on a daily basis. I'm not even gonna get into that, but yeah, I think that, you know, regular social media is going to eat itself alive. Like, I mean, it might reinvent itself a lot, but I think as people kind of learn like the benefits of like not using for-profit platforms, I think it'll grow. You know, it's still fledgling right now, but there's a lot and it's growing on a regular.
Thanks, Jordan. Tristan, would you like to say anything in response?
Well, it seems we're in complete agreement. So, I'll leave it at that.
Okay, thanks then. We've got over to you now, Paddy.
I really enjoyed that talk, Tristan. It took me back as well, because I was one of these kind of early adopters who was on, Usenet, probably not right at the start, but close to the start. In those days, when you got yourself a dial-up modem and a computer, and you know, none of your friends had email addresses, so there wasn't anybody you could email. So Usenet was practically the only people you could talk to, and it was, as you say, it was the top categories of Sci and SOC and Alt and all these things. I just want to so you go and pick the things that you're interested in, but. You said, I think you used the phrase, far from being an online Wild West, right? Well, actually, that's what I found it to be. It was a bit like the Wild West. There was a lot of mutual respect. That's absolutely right. And then there was a sense of community in a lot of the, particularly in the Sci and the historic, ancient history, I was in there. You know, you'd ask a question, you'd get huge replies by people who'd worked really hard to sort of, you know, like they went and looked things up in books. It was brilliant. There was a lot of that, but there was also, and I have to say this, there were also a lot of these news groups that were just full of hooligans and right-wing trolls. I mean, the Usenet was really where trolling was born, and that's the other side of Usenet, that it wasn't all this wonderful, happy, anarchistic, respectful society. There were a lot of real bastards on it, real nasty pieces of work. And because they were kind of anonymous, this is how trolling got started. You know, people can't go and talk to each other in real life the way they did on Usenet, or they'd get punched or bricked. But online and anonymous, they could get away with anything. And by God, it brought out the worst in a lot of people. And this is, by the way, you know, we have this phrase outright. This comes from Usenet. There was this comes from a particular set of news groups called Outright. Started there. The original one wasn't outright. It was just right. But then that wasn't right. That wasn't right-wing enough, so they invented a new top category called alt, alternative, or outright, even more right-wing than the normal right-wing. So you had all shades on there. Anyway, the point I'm getting to is that it was a commerce-free environment and advertising. It was really sort of done for and by nerds like me who were into that sort of thing. I sort of tried to get friends of mine involved in it, and they were like, why? What's it got for me? Why would I be interested in that? Oh, well, you can talk about ancient history. I don't want to talk about that. The people that did Usenet were never really going to industrialize the World Wide Web for the majority of the public. It was only ever going to be a niche thing for people who liked arguing at 4 o'clock in the morning about whether or not one particular Egyptian pharaoh really was as mad as everyone made out. For most people, there was nothing in there of interest. And it really took the sort of the industrializers who drove social media and YouTube and Amazon and things like that. They were the people who really kind of drove it forward. It sounds like I'm praising capitalism, but I'm not really saying that. I think I'm saying that this was inevitable. This was always going to happen, that these big companies were going to take over, because they were going to provide things that people actually did want. And now you've got the situation where it's absolutely gigantic, it's huge, you know, and all this sort of thing. How it's going to develop in the future, I really think it depends on whether the public's going to get really sick of being tracked all the time and monitored and having all their data sold and packaged and fed back to them. You said something about echo chambers, but there were echo chambers back then. People chose the news groups they wanted to be in. You know, you didn't go and sit in outright. If you were a socialist, you went and sat in SOC politics socialism, although that was too general, so there were sub-branches off that. So people chose their own news groups back then. So I think this process of echo chambers is certainly not a new thing that social media has invented. I think it's always been there. But as to the future, I think it really depends how much the public is prepared to put up with the control of social media. Anyway, that's me.
Okay, Paddy. Obviously, quite a bit of stuff there. Do you want to say a word, Tristan?
Yeah, maybe I'll just respond briefly to two of the points that were raised. The first about, you know, people who were abusing the system, trolls, that sort of thing. I mean, of course, I didn't get into that in my talk, and it wasn't really my intention, though it probably came across that way, to paint Usenet as some sort of, you know, online utopia where everybody always got along and we're always kind and friendly to one another. And of course, that's not the case. But Usenet sort of organically developed ways of routing around problems like that. People came up with all sorts of social and technical solutions to dealing with antisocial behavior. And they were, by and large, decentralized solutions. It didn't involve a single network operator deciding to pull the plug on someone across the whole network, because you couldn't do that because it was distributed. But people came up with things like spam filters, abuse filters, that sort of thing, that in many cases very effectively allowed people to deal with it in the manner and to the degree that they felt was necessary to maintain a productive discussion environment for them. And of course, some people, you know, loved engaging with the trolls and flamers, and you know, didn't implement any filtering whatsoever. And well, good for them. Other people decided to use other measures. The other thing about echo chambers, I mean, you're right in that you can always, you know, insulate yourself no matter what sort of discussion medium you're using. My point was rather that in Usenet, it was a bit harder to isolate yourself, whereas Facebook and Twitter tend to do this automatically for you. Facebook and Twitter basically analyze your profile and your past posts and whatnot, and on the basis of that, they determine what other information to show you next. And so if you want to seek out differing viewpoints, you need to do a lot more manual or explicit work than you did on Usenet. In Usenet, there was no automatic processing of any past history of messages. You basically were responsible for trawling through the list of news groups to find something, to find a topic area that you thought might be interesting to you. And once you've got to a specific topic area, basically you had to trawl through all the messages in it. There was no automatic filtering that would tell you which posts to read next or whatnot. So like it or not, you were going to end up getting exposed to other ideas at some level. That's sort of what I meant when I was talking about echo chambers. So
thanks, Tristan. Okay, it's Mike, it's over to you now. You're the next one on the list.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Kristen, for that really interesting discussion that you raised. Just two questions. How does one get into it? Because I've never heard of using it. That's one. And then the second one is, how open is it to misuse by the security, the government security systems?
How is it misused by government security systems?
Yes. There's so many of them around these days.
Okay, well, to answer your first point, you can get on Usenet today the same way you got on it back from the moment it was first launched, and pretty much in the same way that I described in my talk. You just need to go online somewhere on a website, find a Usenet client, download it, install it on your machine, and then, well, actually the next thing is to find a server. And there are some free ones out there. If you can't find one on your own, then feel free to get in touch with me by email, and I can give you some ones to try. If you've used an email client, either now or in the past, as most of us have, you'll probably find the interface to a newsreader very familiar. Basically, you can get started reading and posting to groups. The second question, has it been misused? Well, because it is an open system, it's basically available for anyone to read. I wouldn't say it's been misused by governments, because governments have the same access to Usenet as any one person does. They can read every message on the system the same that same as you can. So in one sense, Usenet is not private, but it also doesn't give you the illusion of privacy that social media does. You would probably be less likely to post confidential information in the mistaken belief that it's safe to Usenet than you would to, say, Facebook. Facebook, you can mark your posts as, you know, friends only or whatnot. But of course, Facebook itself will always have access to that post. And because of this agreement that you, these terms and conditions that you agreed to when you signed up with Facebook, Facebook is and probably has the right to and probably is sharing that private post of yours with who knows how many of its partners and customers and governments and whatnot. In Usenet, everything is out in the open by default, and generally people are aware of that at all times.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Tristan. We don't have anybody else in the chat for the moment. So while we're waiting for other people to come on, which I hope they will, because there's obviously a lot to chat about, can I make a couple of points? First one is Michael Hauben. Liked a lot what he had to say. Hadn't heard of him. Sad that he seems to have died at an incredibly young age. He sounds to me the kind of thing he's saying, like, he sounds to me the kind of person who would have made an ideal socialist. Perhaps you can tell us a little bit more about him, if you have information, Tristan. And the other thing that struck me was how the internet, or whatever you like to call it, has gone the way of all things in capitalism. How it's been commodified. That's what capitalism does. It sells absolutely everything that comes along. Things come along with the best of intentions that don't seem to be connected to the profit system. Before you know it, somebody finds a way of marketizing them, trying to make them profitable. So in a sense, what's happened to the internet is something that is, you could almost argue, inevitable, given the kind of system we live in. Don't know what you'd say to that, Tristan.
Well, yeah, I mean, I agree with this, the second point, and don't really have that much to add to it, except for those who are not familiar with how the internet developed. This grew out of a system called ARPANET, ARPA standing for Advanced Research Projects, I believe, which was basically funded by the United States military. It gave research grants to universities for setting up networks, communication networks between computers as a means of, I suppose, producing some sort of a resilient communication network that would be, you know, able to withstand a Soviet invasion or nuclear war or what have you. And the research funding came with, of course, strings attached, in that since it was public money, it wasn't supposed to be exploited for commercial gain. So you had all these different universities in the United States that had linked their computers together in a giant research network, just, you know, establishing the basics of how computers and people using the computers could communicate with each other. But with the proviso that nobody was supposed to commercialize it. And the system sort of developed in this protected way for a number of decades until the system eventually morphed into, sort of got taken over by the funding got taken over, I think, by the National Science Foundation, which sort of relaxed the rules on the commercial exploitation and sort of the history becomes more modern. At that point, Usenet actually started in a parallel way. It wasn't part of ARPANET or what was originally the internet, but rather it started as a network between a pair of universities that wasn't part of ARPANET, but also wanted to have all this cool networking stuff. And so they set up their own communication network, which became very popular and eventually got linked into the main ARPANET network and sort of merged. The word internet basically refers to a merging of all these separate networks that had existed and developed over the course of several decades, starting from the 1960s. And Usenet, sort of like ARPANET, started off with this sort of, you know, anti-commercial or commercial business hostile setting. I don't think it was anything that was necessarily imposed upon it, but the culture sort of developed that way from the beginning. But of course, you know, once the internet got opened up to commercial interests and business saw that there were niches that they could exploit, ways of making profit, it's sort of, well, you know the rest of the story. As for Michael Halbin, yes, I mean, I'm not sure if it's really my story to tell, given that we have someone attending the talk who knows or knew him quite a lot better. Maybe I should ask, Rhonda is Michael's mother, and I was wondering if she might want to say a few words about how her son got involved in Usenet and whatnot. If she doesn't, then that's fine, and I can say a few words instead. But maybe Rhonda, if you want to, you could unmute and talk. Any interest?
Sure. I'd like to say something about your talk for a minute and about Michael, and then also about a little bit of what you just said about ARPANET and whatever. If that's okay.
Sure.
Yeah, Michael was on BBSs and very excited by them. We lived at the time in Dearborn, Michigan. And by the way, that's where the NSFNet got started, was being built and being developed. And Michael found very wonderful being online and discussing things online, and felt there's a little introduction to the book. By the way, a book that Michael and I wrote, which was called Netizens on the History and Impact of Usenet and the Internet, is online. And maybe Tristan can give the URL. And it's also printed. There's a print edition of it. But Michael's introduction, his preface, which was a talk he gave in Japan, tells a little bit about how he got started on BBS and how excited he was about what they made possible, because we lived in a fairly conservative environment in the 80s, and online was a very different one. And I guess, Tristan, were you on FIDONET? So you also probably have that background and can give some of the, you know, some of that sense. But with Usenet, what was interesting, we heard about it from a Unix user support network that was in Ann Arbor at the time. And I don't want to go through too much about it, but I thought what happened when Michael was going to start at Columbia, he was interested in, he knew the net was being developed, and he was interested in knowing what was its possibility and what could you do to make that possibility a reality. And he never had a utopian view. He always said that people are going to have to work to make it something good. But very early on, one of his professors asked students to do research, but not from books. It was a computer science course. And he said that you have to do it somewhere else, research. So Michael did it online, and it was early in the early 90s. And he put together a series of questions. And what he got back from those questions was amazing. It was very exciting. He got like 100 answers maybe from people who were using the net and were excited to let other people know what it made possible and what how wonderful they felt it was. And at that point, I thought, I appreciate that Tristan used the word netizen. And what happened is Michael saw people were online caring about other people, wanting everybody to be connected. And he called people netizens, citizens, but citizens of the net and or netizens. And later the word got used for everybody, but that wasn't how Michael used the word. He used it to say the people online who care to make this something good and help have it be something that makes our world something good. And so the concept of netizen was created by came from the research Michael did. He discovered that online there were netizens, and he gave a name to that, which was very helpful because people then would call themselves netizen Joe or netizen Frederick or whatever. And there are still people using the term and referring to the term. So I want to recommend looking into all of that. And then I thought I also wanted to, but I thought a big piece of what Michael's work was to feel that there was a fight needed and that fight had to be taken up. And I thought the concept of netizens for a while helped us to take up that fight. And so people should be aware of it was, it really, and by the way, the fight has been taken up in some places and in various situations. And in the 2000s, essentially, what I found is the South Korea, the netizens there, they use the word netizens, and they elected the president of the country, and they tried to have more democracy, and through a period of almost 20 years, they basically found a way to deal with some of the problems they were having. In trying to create a more democratic society. And what's interesting in China too, from the 2000 and then a little bit later, the netizens were also doing some very interesting things. And I'm not sure exactly what's going on now, but it's important to look at what has been developed. But I thought the other piece that I wanted to mention was that I really appreciated a lot of what Tristan presented. I think that needs to be done more often, and to be spread. But I just wanted to clarify that ARPANET and Usenet were very different developments early on, and I thought, and it wasn't the connecting of schools that led to Usenet. It was basically the Unix users groups, which the Linux is now a mechanism, a part of. It was like it's built. It's another form of Unix, basically. I think that's fair to say. I don't know, you know, if that's, but it's there was a community built. What happened was AT&T could not commercialize things except telephones, and they needed better ways of dealing with their computers. So basically, Usenet grew out of the Unix, the operating systems that people at Bell Labs research is created. And so that the, and then essentially they invited also graduate students to work with them. And there's some, a very charming story about a graduate student, Tom Truscott, who was invited to work at Bell Labs because he was interested in chess, and he was very thrilled by that. But then when he went back to Duke University, he was cut off from Bell Labs and he didn't want to be cut off. And there was the basis to create something that would be like an online news, and they needed that. And so he and some friends created that. And that's where the Usenet came from. So it really came from the the Unix community Usenet, whereas the ARPANET is a different development. And, you know, it has its own important developments for people to understand about. So I just wanted to make that, you know, that kind of things clear. And I appreciate that Tristan has done this, because this is what's very much needed. And I hope other people will be interested. And just with regard to the comments, I wanted to say one thing, and that is what I found with regard to Usenet is it taught me and other people how to disagree with each other and how to learn from our disagreements. It wasn't hostile, essentially, the disagreements among the people who cared to spread the net and to be part of it and to cooperate as part of it. And so essentially what I found is I could have, if somebody I fundamentally disagreed with, if we learned how to talk to each other, and then we could get at the point that we disagreed at and find it. So I think regardless of the trolls and whatever, that there were a set of people who learned some very fundamental activity about communication from being on Usenet. And I hope it's possible to get back on Usenet. And I thought Tristan and some of his colleagues are trying to make, encourage that and help that. And I hope we find ways to help them and to work ourselves to do that. Thank you.
Thanks, Rhonda. That's great. Thank you very much indeed for that. Shall we go on then to the next person on the chat, who is Freddie? Over to you, Freddie.
And thank you, Howard. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Yeah. And thank you to you also, Tristan, for the interesting speech that you gave there, the interesting address. I have to say from the outset, though, I mean, I'm not over familiar with the use of social media. It's not something that I'm particularly familiar with. I'm only just getting used to using things like Zoom, etc. So you may understand where I'm coming from on this, but nonetheless, I found what you said very informative and interesting. The question I have, though, Tristan, I don't know if you can answer it or not, but is there any particular medium that you would perhaps be willing to suggest in terms of making it easier for the socialist party to get its message across, that maybe not so much subject to editing or some sort of prohibitive actions, etc., by the social media companies? So, I mean, for example, would you have thought that perhaps something like Usenet, which I hadn't heard of previously, would you think something like Usenet would be a good forum for the Socialist Party to get its case across? Thank you.
Thanks, Freddie. Tristan?
Well, I think that a political party that's trying to break in and get its message across probably has to take a pragmatic approach. You've got to spread your message where there are people going to hear it. And for better or for worse, that probably means using existing social media channels like Facebook and Twitter and whatnot. Simply because that's where the people are, that's where the people are. That isn't to say that we shouldn't also be using less centralized communications channels. I mean, of course, Socialist Party has its own website, which is, you know, has unfettered access to. It can post all sorts of content. Of course, the problem is attracting people to it. And the Socialist Party can use Usenet, of course, and it can use maybe some of the newer social media channels that are trying to be, I suppose, similar to Facebook and Twitter, but without a lot of the negative aspects that come with the centralized control. And Jordan mentioned one of them, which is Mastodon, which is sort of a Twitter clone, except it's decentralized rather than centrally controlled. The only problem with targeting these lesser known media channels is, you know, that it takes some effort to familiarize yourself with them and to get online and to establish a reputation there. And the returns might be relatively low because you're not going to reach as many people. Of course, posting to Facebook and Twitter, you have your own problems, which is some of which were mentioned in my talk, which is, you know, Facebook isn't necessarily going to show what you post there to the right people. It's sort of a no-win situation. So, like I said, the party needs to adopt a pragmatic approach, spread its message wherever it's possible, I suppose, and wherever it's welcome.
Thanks, Tristan. Next in the queue is Jordan again.
What's up? It was just a random thought I always think about. Like when I'm on these kind of platforms, you know, like one thing I noticed when I go on like Twitter, you kind of saw a massive exodus of like far right wingers when Trump got banned from Twitter. You know, a lot of them started using stuff like Gab, Parler. I don't know if those are necessarily decentralized, but, you know, even on like something like Mastodon, like you see a lot of right wingers. I don't know if you might have an idea of this. Why do you think it is that some people, you know, so many people who understand the benefit of like a decentralized, basically nonprofit platform are like basically reactionaries? Like what is like, why are so many of them right libertarians? Like it just doesn't make much sense to me. I mean, maybe you might not have an insight on this, but this is just something I love to like kind of talk to people about sometimes. Like why aren't more socialists taking that step when you see a bunch of like right libertarians doing it, when it seems as though it's like a complete incomplete ideological conflict with their ideas?
Yeah, these people on the right wing who are flocking to these new social media platforms like Parler are doing so, I suppose, mostly out of technological ignorance. What's happening is they're being swindled. There's somebody out there who has an idea but very little technical knowledge, who decides, okay, I want to escape the existing social media companies. I'm going to set up my own. But they're not learning from the lessons of the past. They're not. They don't even have any knowledge necessarily of how Facebook and Twitter works. They're not presenting a technically different alternative to it. They're just hastily cobbling together their own network that's really no different from the ones that they're trying to escape, except that it's being built by people who don't really understand how the system works. And if so, of course, it gets vulnerable to all sorts of intrusions, and of course, all the same sort of either by people attacking the system or governments who are issuing subpoenas and getting all the lists of users and supposedly private posts and whatnot. So basically, there are a bunch of swindles perpetrated by people who have no technical knowledge on people who have no technical knowledge. As to why socialists aren't doing that, well, I'm glad that they're not. Because I don't want them to fall for the same sort of swindles that the people on the right are doing. But the socialist community is actually quite small. I don't really see a dedicated network for socialists is going to be able to sustain itself. I would rather recommend that people who are interested in socialist ideas make use of existing channels, particularly ones that aren't centrally controlled. So yes, by all means, individual socialists should be using things like Usenet and Mastodon to engage in discussions amongst themselves and with possibly interested members of the public. There's no reason why we couldn't take our discussions to these groups.
Thanks, Tristan. Before we go to Steve for the next contribution, can I just draw your attention, if it's not been drawn already, to the link that Tristan has put on the chat function to the book, the Netizens book by Michael and Rhonda. It is there if anybody wants to, there's an online version there if anybody wants to click on it. Okay, Steve, it's you next.
Yeah, thanks, Howard. It's just a question for Tristan, really. You were saying that the initial research into networking was undertaken with the Department of Defense funding. So all these universities involved researching and networking together. But then there was a change. And I was just wondering if you've got any sort, you may not, but whether you've got any information on whether there was any sort of commercial pressure on the government to go away from that anti-commercial stance. Had anybody seen at the time, and any American capitalist organization seen at the time, the chance of a profit if they could only change the rules? So that could be an impossible question for you, but it's of interest to socialists, I think.
I'm sure it's been documented whether or not it happened, and I wouldn't be surprised to learn that it had. In fact, a lot of the early history of the internet, apart from Usenet, is also covered in the Netizens book, where a link has been posted in the chat. Offhand, I don't really know, because I mean, I read the book a long time ago, and in preparing the talk, I only reread the portions that were specific to Usenet, which, of course, most of which had nothing to do with ARPANET. Though it's possible that Rhonda may have a better recollection. She might be able to answer the question. Rhonda, if you're still there.
I unfortunately have to leave in a few minutes, but I do have a section about ARPANET and about the commercial in the Netizens book. So there are sections that I would be glad to go over it with you and such, you know, point to certain things. Commercial pressures, I pointed to recently, I had a fight with Google was one of the commercial pressures. They were awful when they bought some of, there was another company called Deja News that had some archives and had offered Usenet capability. And Google at one point bought some of what Deja had, and we all objected. And that meant our posts. And Google put Google copyright on our posts, which they had no right to do. And they eventually took it off with regard to our objections. But I thought Google was and I did write an article about the different way that Google approached things, which was essentially they were there to make a profit. And our, I thought the online cooperative activity, which was there to create something that would make the world better and make more communication possible. And so I outlined some of that, but I thought the AUP was, there was a fight against commercial people being able to just do anything they wanted. And I thought a big part of that, essentially, originally, it was under the US government, and the US government said there couldn't be commercial activity and there was an acceptable use policy that forbid it, essentially. But that is what happened is that there was the pressure from companies and both to get some control over it and also to change that. And so that was a whole fight that we went through. And there was something called ICANN. So, you know, it would be interesting to go over some of that, but also to put it in the context of the fact that we were fighting to have something that would be a continuation of the cooperative online culture that we had been building, and that the US government essentially gave away its the NSF some of the infrastructure and didn't charge. I mean, they were, let me just back up a minute, because at one point I got on a mailing list, and the mailing list was from, I thought the NSF was part of it, but there were all sorts of the big company people who wanted the net to be private, not and to be corporate. And essentially they were on that to encourage the commercialization. And I had found out about it and I got on it and was sort of fighting the commercialization, and other people were. I mean, so I thought it's a big and important question to look at the different things, but the US privatizing it was a big piece of the problem. And it turned out, my guess is that was an illegitimate act for the US to privatize its piece of the net. And that, so it wasn't, it was the corporations, but it was also the US government that we were fighting with all this. And I thought what one person pointed out to me is we put up a good fight so that there's whatever there is left of it now is because we put up the fight. Otherwise there was the model of AOL, or I'm sorry, the model of CompuServe, where you get charged for the time that you're online, essentially, and you can't be online and you can't help people because you're being charged for it. So the whole fact that there's the model of what got established via Usenet and the work done is because of the work that was done. And so there's the commercialization of it, but there's also what the model got created and what had helped to establish that still is in fact part of it. So I think it's a very important question you're asking, and maybe we should sit down and try to formulate it in a better way, because I think there's two pieces. There's not only the pressures of commercialization, there was also the fight of the cooperative online culture. And so what is the nature of that fight? And I think that fight's still on, and that Usenet, some of it still exists, and that some that people are still trying to be helpful to others. There are netizens still, so there are a lot of pieces, but they get drowned out, and the surveillance issues get made as the issue. But it's somehow in the context of the bigger thing we were trying to do, and that the pioneers were trying to do. So I also have some sections in the book about what, and Michael has some pieces about J.C.R. Licklider and what he intended to create, and that he had the vision for it, and he inspired people about it. And then I went back to Norbert Wiener and looked at the work he had done. And so it's a bigger question in terms of what the effort was to create versus what the privatizers wanted to maintain and continue. So I thank you for asking it. I would hope that it could get taken up again in some useful context. Yeah, I hope that's adequate.
If I can just maybe briefly add something to that. Rhonda mentioned an article that she'd written about Google's attempt to sort of privatize the Usenet archive. You can see my screen now. You can see this is the article she's talking about. I'll add a link to it in the chat so that anyone who's interested can download and read it for themselves. It's a really good article, and I would definitely recommend anyone to read that. It's something I relied upon a little bit in addition to the netizens book when preparing this talk.
Thanks very much, Tristan. And just to say that Raina has put on the chat function a reference to chapter 12 of Michael and Rhonda's book, which will be of interest to people who wish to look at that book. And also Tristan's put a link to Rhonda's article, which he's just mentioned. Right, shall we now...
Can I just say there's a version of the book online, and it's also in a print edition. So I just, maybe Tristan can just put the URL for the book online, but it's if people need it, but there is also a print edition.
Yeah, I did that already.
Okay, Rhonda, thanks for that. Right, next in the queue, it's Mike Foster.
Hello there. Yeah, can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
All right, cheers. Yeah, thanks for that, Tristan, and Rhonda as well. Yeah, lots of interesting and rather scary stuff as well. Yeah, a lot of information there I didn't know about before. Yeah, and it certainly got me thinking. And what one thing that stood out in your talk, Tristan, was the devious way that sort of psychology is used by the social media companies, organisations like Google as well, right from sort of rather basic sort of manipulation by, knowing that people aren't going to bother reading the 130-page long list of terms and conditions you agree to when you sign up for Facebook. But also, of course, much more in a much more detailed way, like you say, where they target adverts to your stated interests and the way it all links up through these sort of mysterious algorithms. So, yeah, what struck me in particular was the very cynical, manipulative, sort of devious way that, that this sort of level of psychology is sort of turned into algorithms as a way of manipulating us. And that's the scary part to me. Yeah, but yeah, thank you for that. Yeah, thanks for drawing our attention to something which I'm sure a lot of us didn't really understand enough about. Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Mike. Don't see anybody else in the speaking queue at the moment. Does anybody else wish to raise any other points or ask any questions? We've sort of been going for, getting towards an hour and a half. We're getting towards the time when we tend to sort of wind up, depending on the number of questions people have got, etc. Don't see any others. So I wonder whether I can therefore ask Tristan if he'd like to give us some kind of conclusion before we end the session.
Well, I can basically sum up in saying that, I've been on Usenet since the early 1990s. I know there are a number of people who are attending this talk who have also mentioned that they've been or had been long-term users of it. There was Patty and Rhonda. I know Rainer's been on it since at least 1998. And so a lot of us have actually, lived through this. We understand the benefits. But of course, probably most of us are also on social media. And I think that's probably because that's where all of our friends and family are, and we want to keep in touch. We probably would prefer it if our friends and family were, less exploitative discussion venues. Probably what's more important to us is our ability to keep in touch. I'm not really sure I have a good solution to that, other than encouraging, a wider societal shift that recognizes the value of working cooperatively towards a common good, which is something that socialists, I suppose, can all agree with. Like I said in the talk, Usenet is still around. I'm actually one of the people who helps to maintain a certain part of it, along with Rainer, who's also here. We help administer the 8 original hierarchies on Usenet to help people through the process of creating or removing groups, finding moderators for these groups, and so on. So if anyone is interested in trying Usenet out and seeing if it's something that you want to use yourself, or maybe as inspiration for some future system, then feel free to get in touch with us, and we'd be happy to guide you through the process of getting online. I suppose in the meantime, if you're continuing to use big name social media, just keep aware of what it is you've agreed to, and how your data is being used. And if you don't know, then it would behoove you to familiarize yourself with the various ways that these companies use your data and the way they are sort of trying to manipulate you and others behind the scenes to their own ends, and consider whether you might be more comfortable using a more traditional but less exploitative, more communally owned and operated medium, maybe despite its drawbacks of a smaller user base. So yeah, I'm glad that everyone came. And again, a big thank you to Adam for having invited me to speak. I understand that he's going to be pestering me into writing up my talk as an article. So perhaps this will reach a wider audience through the journal. So thanks again.
Thanks to you, Tristan. Thanks very much indeed for an extremely interesting talk. I'm sure everybody here will agree with that. And good night to everyone here. Thanks for attending.